So chapter 35 of the Tao Te Ching says that she who is centered in the way can go where she wishes without danger. She perceives the universal harmony even amid great pain because she has found peace in her heart. Music or the smell of good cooking may make people stop and enjoy, but words that point to the way seem monotonous and without flavor. When you look for it, there is nothing to see. When you listen for it, there is nothing to hear. When you use it, it is inexhaustible. Yes, I will. It felt like an again one. It's those ones that sneak up on you at the end. They need to be read again. So we'll have some gender sharing here and say that he who is centered in the way can go where he wishes without danger. He perceives the universal harmony even amid great pain because he has found peace in his heart. Music or the smell of good cooking may make people stop and enjoy, but words that point to the way seem monotonous and without flavor. When you look for it, there is nothing to see. When you listen for it, there is nothing to hear. When you use it, it is inexhaustible. I think I'll keep that one open. We might have to refer to her today. So last week we began to talk about Chatvari Arya Satyani, the Four Noble Truths. That's the Sanskrit words for them. And this is like watching a television show that's a series. And so last week on at New Dharma, we talked about the fact that the Four Noble Truths is the first teachings that the historic Buddha Gautama expounded. We talked a little bit about his potential like daddy issues that made him leave home and go out into the world with the recognition that you cannot keep people from the truth of the world and the suffering of the world, that we eventually have to face the truth for ourselves. So Gautama's father's efforts, Suddhodana's efforts to shield his son, knowing that there was the potential for him to become a great spiritual teacher rather than a warrior king, were for naught. Buddha went anyway. And so after all of his trials and tribulations and figuring out that starving himself wasn't quite the answer, and of course neither, as he had already experienced, was simply living in the lap of luxury in a kind of dullness and inattention to the truth of the world, he began to find the middle way. And he began to teach this middle way throughout the rest of his years, another 45 or so years of teaching. And so the first teaching, he expounded four truths. And what's critical about these four truths is that, first of all, you must know that the notion of Buddhism is essentially a Western construct. What people did was to follow, in the same ways that Christianity is a construct, right? That what people did originally was to simply follow in the footsteps of the Buddha, to follow in the footsteps of Jesus, to do as this person, human being, with all their flaws and foibles, did, so that they may find a way for themselves that didn't exclude them because of their humanity. So it's very important. And the Buddha himself said repeatedly that the only reason in which there was any usefulness whatsoever to sit and listen to these teachings was to seek out the potential to cease suffering, to seek the end of suffering. That other than that, there was no reason. That you would use these teachings to seek the end of suffering and act accordingly. He didn't say it was so you could become a nice person. He didn't say it was so that you could get along with everybody in the kind of, can't we all get along way. He didn't say it was for any of that. It was to seek the end of suffering. But before we could seek the end of suffering, we have to understand a little bit about what was called the cause of suffering. And so that's the second noble truth, the cause of suffering. Sanskrit and Pali are both very rich languages. And if you have heard any Buddhist teachings or even Advaita and Hindu-based teachings, you've probably heard a lot of conflicting information where someone says, well, this is what this means, and someone says, well, that's what this means. And it gets kind of confusing. And the reason is because the language itself is so rich and full of meaning, right, with each of the root words, that we just don't have words, individual words that correspond in English directly to those words in Sanskrit, right? So the Buddha actually spoke Prakrit, which is a less refined form of Sanskrit. Sanskrit, in fact, means refined as a language. It means refined. So the Buddha spoke, he spoke a little street. Right? He had a little flavor going on. But when all of the priests and monks got a hold of it, they had to refine it and began to offer the teachings in Sanskrit. Of course, they were first translated into Pali because that was the language of the masses, and that's what the Buddha wanted. He wanted the masses. And it got a little highfalutin, and they got to Sanskrit, and so they began to present the teachings in Sanskrit. But it's a very fascinating language, and when you spend a little time with it, which I think is really important, which is the only reason that I keep talking about Sanskrit, the terms and the root words here, because it might pique our interest to go and look at these words for ourselves rather than to simply rely on the translations that have come down through the sensibilities, filters, and needs of those that have been holding this access to this information, which has for the last 40 years in America been upper middle class to wealthy. Actually, it began with wealthy to upper middle class white Americans, right? And so we have translations that are filtered by those needs. This is not a bad thing, right, in and of itself, because people pull meaning and ascribe meaning for their own needs. Of course they do, right? So it's not like this was a bad thing and someone set out to do something wrong and give us bad translations. But many of the translations early on actually had so much correlation to Christianity, we had some sense that maybe there's a little bit of filtering going on here, right? And so it's very important to... when you can, when you have the opportunity, as an aspect of deepening your practice and relationship, to go back to mother tongues. And to, you don't have to go and, take a whole course on Sanskrit or Pali, but to just, dig in a little bit. I mean, now we have Google. Who needs a class, right? So you just go to Wikipedia and find out, what those words meant at their root, and you begin to pull something out. So dukkham samudaya is the truth, is the cause of suffering. This word samudaya, actually, its root means something like what's up with something, right? So samudaya it gets translated into cause, but it's sort of like, what's up with suffering? It's the thing that comes up with suffering. And the thing that comes up with suffering, that is kind of like living wholly with suffering, is what they call tanha, and which is often translated as, much to American Western sensibility, chagrin, desire. Right? So like, oh, Buddhism, I'm not trying to do that, because they're all against desire. And we are a culture of satiating our desires. That's what we want to do. All we would try to figure out is, like, how can we, like, make something work for us? This, I want that, I want this, I don't want that, I don't want that. So fulfilling all our desires, both desire in the positive sense, but also desire in the negative expression, meaning I don't want that. So there's both I want, and I don't want this. There's also craving, right? So craving is also one of the words. Tanha's like desire, craving. Attachment. I think most viscerally, thirst. Thirst. It's not just the mere wanting. Okay, so I think that's important for people to understand. It's not simply want appears and therefore you have already created all this kind of suffering. It's the other word that often gets expressed, attachment. To that desire. So it's not the mere arising of desire, it's our over-identification with that desire. It's our over-identification with the thirst, the over-identification with the craving. So want everything that you want to want. Don't expect it to be so. And you actually still have peace. When people get a notion in their head that it's just about not having any desires whatsoever, we just feel like, you know, okay, count me out. Enlightenment's not for me. Awakening's not going to happen here. Because I have a whole lot of desires and a whole lot of thirsts and a whole lot of cravings. But this nuance of attachment to those things is key for understanding how this still hangs out in the human realm of possibility to work with. So we're talking about something that's very, very workable. It's not impossible. Buddhism gets a bad rap. All right? It's for good reason. Here it is. The first noble truth, suffering. The second noble truth, you got desires. I mean, we're just starting out on a bad foot here. They needed a good publicist to work this situation a little bit better. Somebody should have said, you know, that's not going to fly in certain places. But the nuances give it more color, right? It's just like the Tao Te Ching was saying, words that point to the way are monotonous and without flavor. That's just suffering and suffering because you have desires. That's pretty monotonous and without flavor, don't you think? And life is juicy. And we want it to remain juicy. And I think a lot of us teeter somewhere on the edge of not being quite sure if we really want to go down this spiritual path, whatever path it might be, because it means we're going to be stripped of our humanity. It means we're going to be stripped of juiciness. It means that we won't be able to make a raunchy joke. And everyone that knows me knows that that's not true. We want to be juicy. We want our chi to still flow. We want our vibrancy. We want our life. We want our zest. We just don't want them to be the things that drag us down into the mud. So there was no secret here. Lots of fluttering in the midst of the second sit. Lots of moving around. And if you noticed, the beginning movements were, you know, little. Oh, I've got a little. little bit of disease here. Let me try to work it out. And then it passed on to someone else. Well, they're working their disease out, so let me work mine out. And it just becomes like a wave, like in the stadium. Right? And then everyone's trying to work out. Oh, and it's not pain. I know the difference. It's not pain. It's like my toe is caught under my knee. Let me move that. My ear is itching. It becomes all of these things, right? And dukkha, as a word, covers all of that. We talked about it last week. It covers all of that. Dukkha covers all of that disease, all of that, like, it's the pain of pain, the pain of impermanence, the pain of change, right? And the pain of being aware of the truth of suffering. The pain of being aware that pain is out there. So it covers the whole thing. And this thirst, craving, desire, attachment is the same in its richness in that it covers all of it, right? The desire to, like, have my ear, not just have my knee stop feeling like it's going to bleed right here on the cushion, but to also have that little hair that's now touching my ear move out the way. And we just start getting into all of them. Indiscriminate, right? So I'm not saying, folks, like, sit there, suffer, die. You're not going to die. You might faint, but you're not going to die on the cushion. I'm going to tell you that. I almost said it during the sit, but I thought I'd wait for the talk. Much more dramatic. I promise you, you will not die. Faint, yes. Die, no. But who is moving anyway? That's really what we're here to figure out. Who is moving? Not, you know, is it Evan? Is it Twee? Is it Marie? Not that kind of who is moving. Who is it that's moving? Who is it that needs to seek after not just a little bit of freedom from, like, excruciating pain, but, you know, the soft wisp of my hair on my face kind of discomfort. Where does that come from? And really, how solid is it if you really look into it? Can you even make your desire hold? Can you even make the wanting, the craving after that little bit of extra comfort, can you even get that to remain solid? We're even distracted from our own misery. Isn't that a little crazy? There we are thinking we are just in the worst miserable place in life possible. And we get a little itch and it disappears. All our suffering, all our misery, all our impossible situations disappear. It's fleeting, but it disappears as if it were never there. I want to know, who is it that chooses to go back to the place of misery instead of choosing the moment where it's all gone? What's happening in there? What is that about? I have no idea. But we should wonder. It's really true. This is what happens. A lot of translators don't like this, but I talked about once before that I think our modern, best modern phrasing for tanha is addiction. I don't mean medical addiction. I mean the latent potential for addiction that lies in each of us. The need to fill something that is unstoppable. The need to distract ourselves with unbelievable, unwavering effort. To distract ourselves away from what's right in front of us. To distract myself away from the truth of my hair right here. Or the truth of, I have a body. And it is subject to pain. The truth of, okay, it's cold. It's not the worst thing that's ever happened. The truth of, okay, it's warm. It will pass. And everything does pass. All of it. It's almost debilitating the way in which it passes. Because sometimes we are actually really actively trying to hold on to some of that suffering. And it just slips between our fingers. It's kind of annoying. It's like you want to kind of work it, you know? It's like, I didn't get enough out of that moment. Because I want to channel some of my mom stuff and dad stuff through this moment of, like, that way way that person looked at me. What? And, you know, somebody says something and you're distracted. And it's like, damn, I was trying to be really pissed off. And through this miraculous practice of just being willing to see the truth, do you know what happens? You increasingly lose this ability to hold on to your own suffering. You just lose it. It's a little scary. You witness your own ego trying very hard to find it. Our friend Choyun says this. It's like being at the airport. You lose your baggage. And what's more intense than losing your baggage is how badly you want it sometimes. You really do. You're like, I want my baggage back. And it doesn't have your best pair of shoes in there. There's no camera. It's old stuff that needs to go. And so I want to scare the life out of you until you continue to sit with that sweet balance of effort and letting go, and you will begin to lose your baggage. It will be a shock. And you will try to hold on. And it's all a good sign that the next noble truth, that there is a path, a way to end suffering, to have it, there's a cessation of suffering. The truth of cessation is actually a reality. So. Yeah. When you think about this, if you do later or tomorrow or next week, and you're tempted to think about desire or craving or attachment into some big, looming kind of way, just remember how expansive it is and how pervasive it is. And look for all of the ways in which you are moment by moment grasping, craving, pulling, or pushing, avoiding, averting the truth of the moment that's in front of you. First see it, and then we can talk about how to end it. Oh, that's really good. I have a feeling our guest chefs are slightly behind, so we can take a few questions.
How long have you been here?
Oh, I think... Yeah. I was like, here. Okay. You mean in this physical location? Yeah, just about a year and a half, I think. Is that right? A year and a half. They say yes. Yes. Welcome.
And there's a question that I have there. I just don't know what it is yet. Can you speak on the expanse?
You know, we have bad habits of doing this, teachers.
Mm-hmm.
We basically, like, leave you all little breadcrumbs to be sniffing after way before you need to bother about that.
Okay.
I mean, work out the suffering piece.
Mm-hmm.
The truth of suffering before you worry about the expanse. It's out there. It, you know, I mean, it's there. It's real. And teachers exist, some of us, some of them, I don't know if I'm one of them, but somebody exists to keep hinting at you, to keep, like, going... You know, while you, like, trek down this, like, rocky, rocky road, you know, with no shoes on, rocky, thorny, rough. I mean, I love the, like, paths that talk about how easy and blissful it is. I don't think they lived in Oakland. I don't think they lived in New York. You know what I'm saying? I'm like... I mean, I've been all kinds of places. I haven't found a place yet that, like, the path is just easy and blissful. So I just like to acknowledge the truth of, like, it's rough. You know, we have some ugly, ugly stuff to be looking at, to be checking out. It's, like, scary. Like, you know. When you first start, you think, oh, yeah, I know I have some issues to work out. I'm going to work them out. And you, you know, kind of work through some things, some little things. And you're like... Oh, this is great. And you get the little bliss stage. You're like, this is fabulous. And I'm a meditator. And then the world falls out from underneath you. And you get to see the real deal. And this time, without your glasses. Without your rose-colored glasses that was keeping you completely, you know, in the dark. To the truth of how deep we are. You know, we're deep. We're, like, deep. And the things that we can get ourselves into, the things that we can take on, the things that we can manage to carry around, it's deep. I love when people say, I'm not strong enough. I'm like, well, you are carrying an awful lot of stuff for somebody that's not strong. Don't sell yourself short. You're carrying all that baggage. Once you let some of it go, you can carry the world. And that's what this path is about. Release some of the burden of, like, your stuff, and you can carry, and as warriors are meant to do. You can begin to help to carry the burden of the world, but you can do it seeing clearly what it is and not mistaking your stuff for their stuff and their stuff for your stuff and kind of mixing it all in and, you know, just one big mess. Then you're clear about it, it's very clean, and you're doing it like out of a place of willingness and a place of intention and a place of showing up. And yeah, there's expanse. There's contraction. If it just stays expansive, you have either like slipped over the edge, right, into la-la land, or you're just fooling yourself. It expands and contracts for all of us. Up until the moment that we are beyond any caring, concern, any discrimination whatsoever about the phenomenal world. And then we're of no use. You know what I'm saying? We're of no use. It's great. Somebody has, like, you know, gone and ascended to... Some of you will know, I watched Stargate SG-1. So you go and you ascend. No damn use. Because you're just up there going, And that's beautiful. If that's the idea of enlightenment you're holding, what good is that? You know, this is where the action is at. This is where it matters. And there may be many other lives. I believe there are many other lives. I'm sure. My mother always says, she's like, you're Japanese in another life. I'm sure. But this is the one that I have to work with. This is the one that I most remember for the time being. And this is the place that I'm alive and can touch and can love and can fail and can... you know, fall and can get up again and can experience joy and experience pain and, like, you know, mix it all around and juggle it a little bit and get in there again. And some days it's really big and expansive and I love everybody, and some days, you know, go away. Go away. Contract into this big. And good, right? Good. That's the way that it should be. And wanting after, like, just being like, you know, I'm expansive all the time. You expand out to here, and then you're like, you know, it's like getting a bad facelift. You're just, like, stuck in one position. And again, there's no juice. It's brittle. It isn't supple. It isn't flexible. I could walk around and smile and be like, you know, baby. But sometimes folks need a little, like, get off your ass! And that's what they need to hear. And if I was just walking around being like, groovy, baby, oh yeah, that's good, oh yeah, no problem, folks would be like, okay, like, what can I get from her? Because she doesn't understand what my life is, what's happening in my life, what's going on in my life. Because it's rough. So we need folks that are willing to be here, willing to be warriors with all of the mess and the mud, you know, the expansion and the contraction. And we have to love all of it, the waxing and the waning, the ebbing and the flowing, all of it. It's all the same. There's no difference. We only create the difference in our mind. We only create the effort after the expanse in our mind. As yet another form of delusion, as another way of being distracted from just what is. Flowers have to pull in, drop down to the ground, disappear, and seed a new birth. If we just wanted them to hang out smiling at us all the time, their potency, their vibrancy, their life is gone, and we have Monsanto, genetically modified, you know, whatever they are, seeds and everything. And that's not what we want. It's not what we want for the foods that we eat, the people that we love, the life that we live. So we take it all, and we learn to receive it all as just the truth of what is, and that's the peace. That's where the peace comes from. It doesn't come from, see this word cessation, I'm not going to say much about the third, but it doesn't come from like making it stop, right? It's not about making it stop, because when it stops, it's all over. Game over, we're done. It's the truth. It's coming into the truth of this is what it is. That's why the first noble truth is the most important, by far. Just, if you had to drop all of them, keep the first noble truth, the truth of suffering. That's the one that has every other teaching bound into it. That's the one from which Buddha himself extracted the rest of it. And he's no different than any of us. He wasn't gifted. He wasn't special. He was persistent. He was brought the intention of warriorship to really looking deeply. And each of every one of us can do that. He suffered in the same way that we suffered. And each of us have that capacity, don't we? And so we can keep the first noble truth and just work that, and in and through that find everything else that we need. So we don't need to go too far. We can just stay with what's true for us right now. And you may not be able to articulate whole books worth of information about the wherefores and the whys. But in the place that it matters most, you will truly know. Have the wisdom that comes from your own direct experience of the truth. I don't know what else is really useful beyond that. Buddha himself said,